ngicela uhambe uyofuna umsebenzi.
Uzoyithola kanjani hlelo khoneni?
Yonke into, impahla, imali.
This adulting thing, hey.
Ukuhamba imali.
Wizi nakayithoka challenge.
Awuna moto, imali. Kufanele kube nemali phakathi.
Sebenza.
Sebenza.
Yeva mntanami.
Sebenza.
Welcome once again to another episode of Sebenza Lives Behind the Hustle. It is Tango, your host, riding solo once again. We are hoping Ndokozo's going to make it back. We really miss her. Paige is smiling at the back. She's like, aww, we miss Ndokozo. but let's not be sad. We've got an amazing guest today, Gamza Mbata.
Yes,
now,
sir.
I always say with my guests, if let's assume some people are born under a rock,
yeah,
they've never seen KTV,
right.
They've never seen Super Sport.
Uh-huh.
Who is Gamza Mbata and what does he do?
Okay, well, I think due to the fact that I started out on Kids TV, I'm one of the more younger veterans of the media game, having started at the age of 10 in Kids TV, did that for 8 years, then moved on to radio, which was rather organic. It was one of those by chance things where I had been working in a studio late in my teens that had ENF, who was a 5FM DJ at the time, as one of the partners. And he was like, wouldn't you like to, you know, try some radio? And I was like, yeah, sure. Sounds like a cool career path to follow. And he put me in touch with the guys at 5FM. Nick Grubb was the talent manager at the time, and then he kind of roped me in. I did a couple of dry runs in the catacombs of the SABC. If you've ever been to the SABC, it's a multi-layered building. People think like the structure above the ground is all there is to it, but you can actually go down into some of the most like quiet studios, because I know, which I'll get to in a second, it was where we used to kind of like spend hours upon hours making music. So yeah, I did 5FM for a little bit. I had a cultish kind of show, had a cult following called The Essence on Sunday nights. It was, way ahead of its time. It was a hip hop show where we kind of just, you know, played around with the whole fact that we're after the threshold where you could kind of get away with playing like the, you know, album edits of songs. So there was a lot of like swearing.
Around what time was this?
When was that? That was around like 2003, 2004 that I started in radio. So that show was like really born out of the fact that I was like this kid who had just stumbled across the internet. And it was early days, but there were these hip-hop forums and hip-hop websites where a lot of the music was just kind of available to download. And so I just took it upon myself to put together the best at the time of what was available. And so I would take that, burn these CDs, and then go to studio on a Sunday and kind of like play these, you know, songs that no one had ever heard. Or if they had heard them, it was never on radio. It was because like you either listened to them in your own personal time or your friend told them about, friend told you about them. So yeah, I kind of gathered all these songs and had these really crazy features on the radio where I would kind of get like all these instrumentals and then get the public to phone in and choose an instrumental for the rapper that I would have in studio as a guest to rap over. And then we'd do stuff like where, you know, we kind of get a producer and play his whole catalog, or go back and find the samples for songs that were sampled in hip hop and play the original and kind of mix them into the song. So it was a really creative outlet for me. And then kind of was the start and spark for my passion for music. I mean, even at KTV, I mean, we had a CD player in the makeup room. And I was always like the controller, like when I was working.
Okay.
I'd be the guy coming through with like
DJ comes
CDs
kind
and,
of thing.
Yeah, yeah, you know, so it kind of was like a, and it's funny because a friend of mine who I grew up with, we've known each other since we were like in primary school, him and I would, at his house on weekends when I'd visit, he had one of those ghetto blasters and a tape recorder. And we were used to like fake radio shows in his bedroom with his younger brother being a caller. And it was, it was, you know, it's funny when I look back to it because that's how it all started. Then the bug kind of got me with that radio show. I was able to kind of come, my paths crossed with a lot of rappers, a lot of guys like Pro Kid, WHP, Gulichana. And so it was a kind of natural progression when I met up with the guys of Entity, Now, Entity back then, it was a.k.a. Sizwe Mpofu Walsh and Nhlanhla, who was also the third member of the group. But then a very little known story is that Books, who's like known as my production partner in the Ivy League and an artist in his own right, he was actually the fourth unofficial member of Entity. Like, his parents weren't down with that whole be a rapper during high school thing.
Even as a super fan of the Entity group, I'm like, oh, I didn't know this.
Exactly. So he was the guy, he actually produced Touch and Go.
Mm.
So he was behind the scenes making beats for the guys. And then I managed Entity for the smallest amount of time. But then all the guys had, like, you know, varied interests. And as you can see now with Sizwe, he went on to go study overseas. Tla became a lawyer.
Yeah.
And Kenan was the only one who was keen on kind of pursuing the music thing further. So between him, myself, and Books, who kind of, you know, was moving from out of the shadows, we started the Ivy League. And so the Ivy League was a production collective that early on worked with Pro Kid. We did quite a few songs on Donkey Sun and Snakes and Ladders. Then we worked with Dukes. We worked with Sugar Smacks. We did Tzwak Stickem and No More Hunger for Kuli Chana. So yeah, we had a very good run and in a formative time for South African hip hop, because one of the major criticisms of my show in the early days was that I played a lot of overseas content.
Mm.
But then the reason I did that was because they kind of had set the benchmark. And I said, listen, I'll play whatever as long as you're good enough or as good as the song I played before and are going to be as good as the song I play after, then I'll play your music. So what you got was this knock-on effect where guys' content got better because they wanted to be on the show. So I think, you know, subliminally, it did this thing of, like, guys knowing that they had to kind of raise the bar. And so
barometer of sorts.
Yeah. Because they knew that, like, if I'm going to be before an Immortal Technique song or after a Nas song, I literally have to be on that level. So it was great because the likes of Dome was a great producer around the time. And we kind of did songs for Pro together. And so there was a lot of stuff that he was doing with guys in DK, the likes of 985, who I had an infamous little beef with at the time, which got squashed. I mean, they were complaining that I wasn't playing a song. And I said it wasn't good enough. And then, you know, they came in the studio, and then one of the guys, when we were talking in the interview, because I wanted to get to the bottom of it and give them the right of reply, dropped an F-bomb on the radio. And yeah, it was, I mean, I think if Twitter existed back then, we would have been trending due to that altercation. So yeah, Ivy League developed, and then we, you know, did some songs. We put together, obviously, Kenan's first mixtape, which was 24/7 366, and much of his first album as well, until we all kind of parted ways and went on various paths. So yeah, that was that. And then I moved on to sport, had a stint with Super Sport for a couple of years, and then I just kind of felt like if I wanted to do something on my own, the time would be now.
Mm.
Now being maybe now, what, 18 to months ago to 24 months ago, where I said, you know what, I want to do something that is my own. You're never going to make all the money that you want working for someone else. And I just didn't see where I was headed. It was a big brand to work for, but in all honesty, everyone was an island. You never got any sense of guidance as to this is where you fit in and this is where we see you in a couple of years' time. So because of that, and not having the security of a defined career path and just kind of operating in isolation, I thought, okay, you know what? Don't have kids, not married. If I'm going to try something, probably now is the time. And that's when I left to pursue what I guess is unfinished business as far as the music industry was concerned.
Did you leave your presenting? Or?
Yeah, I left Super Sport entirely to focus on starting a studio and kind of getting back into making music credibly. And so that's where we're at. I mean, for the past year, we've lots of ups and downs. I mean, starting a business is very difficult, especially in this current climate. A lot of people who have, like, a day job would think you're crazy to do that. And it does take a special kind of person to do it. And, you know, there was some planning involved, resources you have to have, obviously, before you go into that. And you're employing people. You're looking to build something that may not provide the returns initially, but if you stick it through and have a bigger vision and a plan and a black book of the right people, to help you kind of grow what you're trying to do, then it's something that can be done. So that's where I am. I mean, business owner now, employ one person, and him and I are kind of the creative force as far as the label and the Music Solutions company is concerned. So Music Solutions being like an agency, when people are looking for something that's music related for either a project, campaign, they can come and see us and we'll create something bespoke for them, kind of to a brief, and trying to grow in that space. So yeah, I mean, it's exciting, but it's also nerve-wracking. I've not been as stressed. I've kind of coasted through life with opportunity after opportunity after opportunity, which is great because I don't think any of it was due to me knowing anybody, and that's why it happened. I think it's always people look at your body of work and look at your capability, and they base it on that. I mean, SuperSport, for instance, I had to audition just like everybody else. It was a new show called PSL News, kind of got in with that. And then once I was in, I was able to kind of finesse that into opportunities doing PSL matches. I did the Bundesliga when SuperSport still held the rights. I did a couple of big matches. I remember doing the Derby, the El Clasico, and that was very early in. And you know, that was just a sign of trust from the person who put me there, having known. And that was a funny thing. When I went back to SuperSport, a lot of people who had worked with the KTV had moved from maybe working in the control room to now being in management positions. So because they knew my work, they were like, here's an opportunity. You know, was some of it too much too soon? I don't know. But, you know, I did it to the best of my abilities and I felt like I was growing. But, you know, the growth wasn't good enough for me personally because I'm a very ambitious person. So eventually I was like, okay, cool. I think this has run its course. It wasn't itch that I'd wanted to scratch, and I think I'd done that. Mm. And lots of people will look back and ask me, like, do you think you've done enough? And I say, listen, I mean, my whole mantra throughout my life has been, if I'm not happy, I move on. And that's the way it should be. But I was very fortunate because I think I'd put myself in a position where through the decisions I'd made growing up, I didn't have anything that was kind of forcing me to stay. You know, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of the time, think about leaving their current work situation, but have a bond, have kids, have a family, have people to support, and they can't do that. So I think I just used those opportunities because I remember I had a lot of colleagues that I worked with at SuperSport who were frustrated but couldn't do anything about it because this is the situation they found themselves in. And so I just thought, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be here another couple of years and thinking, man, I really don't like being here and frustrated, and yet I didn't do anything about it. But I think the capacity to do something about it depends on your situation as an individual. So I'll never judge anyone who couldn't do anything about it. But I knew I had to kind of take my future into my own hands, and that's what I did.
Something I'm curious about, you know, especially with starting a musical production company. What were some of the difficulties you had starting that kind of a business?
Well, I think the difficulties you have is that, you know, with anything nowadays is that there's a certain oversaturation. And a big thing that is in South Africa is that because it's not formalized and we don't have, like, you know, bodies that educate and help people understand the value of what they do, you have a lot of undercutting that happens. So, you know, you've got people who are desperate to get on and will charge rates that aren't sustainable, you know, in terms of what they're willing to offer their music for, and at times also give it away completely in signing over the rights for such music. So you're dealing with people who are hungry, who could do something for less than what you're doing. So they're essentially thinking with their stomachs and not their heads. And that's very hard to compete against. And it happens a lot in South Africa in various sectors where people are not speaking to each other. It's not like Tango. Let us as creators make sure that this is the bottom, this is the benchmark as far as pricing is concerned, so that no one can come in and distort the market by paying what's not really the going rate. So those are some of the challenges. And then there's a lot of protected interests. I think a lot of people realize that if you get into the right parts of the music industry, there's money to be made. So that includes, you know, obviously kind of making music for ad campaigns and for big brands, So, you know, there's people who've kind of monopolized that through understanding music. And that's a big thing that I realize is that a lot of young guys don't understand how it works. I mean, we've got this thing with MT happening now. And it's, you know, music 101. You got to have a lawyer read through any contract that's put in front of you. And a lot of labels, you know, some of them will use your eagerness against you, knowing full well that you want to just be out there and performing a recording. They're going to put something in front of you that doesn't favor you. And because they know your excitement and your zeal will overtake your thinking, you're going to sign because you want to get on. You're not really going to pay attention to the details. And, you know, as the saying says, the devil is in the detail. You can't, as a musician, think you're going to get given the world and, you know, someone's not going to expect anything back. And that tends to be the case. I mean, you just hear a lot of it all over the years. Various labels have given their artists things, material things, and when it's time for the artist to move on or when the artist wants to move on, they say, okay, sure, you can, but there's a tiny matter of this bill of things that we've kind of, you know, provided for you in advance, and you haven't made the money to pay them back yet, so we need to sort that out. So that's, you know, that's the nature of the business. Essentially, record companies are just huge banks with the relationships and the infrastructure to kind of amplify what you're doing, but I think the world has changed and things have leveled up a bit, you know, where you have a situation where, you know, guys can stay independent and be sustainable and make strategic partnerships with labels where it's certain services that you kind of take a la carte to help your end. And there's no need now to sign full-blown deals. It doesn't make any sense anymore because it hasn't changed. Instead, because of the diminished value of the physical recording and CDs and streaming and all this, they're now trying to get, you know, their money from other parts of the pie. So merchandising, performance now is a big thing. So a lot of deals you sign now with a label.
Is it a good or bad thing, would you say?
I don't know. I think it's not bad if you have leverage. Problem is when you're a new artist and you're just kind of signing on, the label, rightfully so, will say they're taking all the risk. That's a fact. So what you want to do is kind of work yourself up to a point. And, you know, if you get to a ceiling and you say, this is as far as I can take myself, hopefully by that time you've amassed enough of a base of fans that a label can see that, you know, this guy's kind of worked himself up to a place where he's got 100,000 people following him. With our infrastructure and with that as a fan base, we can either grow it or monetize it. And so it's not a bad thing if you know what you're getting into and you're clear about what all parties are getting from each other. It's not a bad thing because, you know, some labels have other parts or have stakeholders overseas. If that's something you're trying to do, they can get you there easier within their own network. So, you know, you have things like that where it can be beneficial, but you have to kind of go into it with your eyes wide open.
Now, you know, and it's something kind of inspired by the MT debacle sort of comes about. What is that relationship from producer to the different, you know,
well,
labels
I think producers, you know, have the benefit of kind of operating in a sweet spot where, you know, you kind of create something for someone and there's documentation in place and you kind of let it go and someone pays you for your services and you kind of earn your royalties. But like I say, some producers don't know that after you've even sold a beat, you can still earn. And I mean, it's fair to say that, you know, sometimes someone will disclose that and you'll agree to it, but it doesn't have to be the case. You know, if you contribute to a musical work, it's only kind of right that you, you know, benefit from it for the length of the work being exploited. So that's why you have a lot of like older guys who know the publishing game and know how it works and know that you just gotta, you know, have a stable of either writers or composers and let them do their thing, sit back and exploit the music and then kind of see the income coming in. So in this day and age, you have to kind of be, you know, multifaceted in your approach. So even for us as a studio, a big part of it is publishing because I don't necessarily think that everything we make will be able to place here in SA. So it's about strategic partnerships with people who have connections overseas, who you can say, here's the body of work, take it, go forward with it, see if you can find someone who'll either use it the way it is or sing on it or whatever. And that's how you build up your publishing catalog. And, you know, who knows? Maybe a movie will come along where they want to take a song and sync it. Maybe, I mean, you know, I'm speaking to a company now who have had great luck in kind of placing things from here overseas. Whereas here they'll meet a bit of resistance because, you know, it's a different kind of approach. Overseas, the brands are looking to the labels to say, put us on. Here, the labels are begging to be put on. So what you then have is a situation where they kind of just go with the safe bet. So if a song is huge, then yeah, of course, we're going to kind of put it with an ad campaign. But there's no nuance of like, you know, you'll see an Apple campaign and it'll be a song that you've never heard of, but is a great song. Someone did their homework. Someone got the A&R right. Someone went and found a song that might not be big, but speaks to the message that's been communicated in the campaign. So, you know, that you want to operate in a market like that because not everyone's trying to make chart-topping hits and you don't need that to be the case all the time. I think there's room for subtlety overseas. Here, not so much. You know, I think people always, like I say, go for the big bets, the big songs, who's done well. It's a numbers game, yeah. Whereas it's a bit more nuanced overseas.
Do you think there could ever be a time where both entertainment industry, and I mean now from the visual perspective, and the music industry can come to a point where there's going to be bigger changes?
It's tough to say. I think it takes a visionary. It takes someone on the other side of the table to say, listen, guys, approach it in this way. Go find me songs that are kind of subtle. And, you know, that's why you have a lot of like sound alikes. When you listen to an ad, you know, you'll be like, that sounds familiar. And it's because they've kind of taken something that exists already, replayed it and, you know, made it familiar. No one wants to take that risk of saying, listen, no one knows a song, but it's so on the nose for what we're trying to do. Let's use it. I don't know. I mean, for me, I just see the trend. Anyone who's trying to do something on a highly recognized and highly credible stage, I'll take Trevor Noah, I'll take Loyiso Okola, I'll take guys who've seen the need to move out of South Africa to kind of, you know, box with the best, because that's how you measure yourself. I think there's still a case of us kind of all fighting over the small pie here, instead of kind of opening yourself up to thinking in a global context and saying, cool, you guys can do this and I'll participate here because obviously this is my home, but my plans are grander and bigger than that. And so there is a global economy that I think South African musicians can participate in. And I think it's one that the older guys in the game have known about for years. If you know, the profile of the most successful publishers is usually a very quiet, older white gentleman who just understands how publishing works. And, you know, he's creating library music. It's not the sexiest thing in the world. But, you know, if it's getting on 5 programs and those programs are being repeated over and over, it all adds up in the end. You know, those are guys cashing the big checks. So, yes, you can get there via radio play and being on radio. But I think, you know, considering the fact that, you know, there's pay for play, there's so many things that are out of your control, it's not the most reliable way to go about it, because I don't think you'll get a true reflection of your talent and what you it's distorted, because now you're having to add the influence of money, you're having to add other influences instead of it just being a meritocracy where talent takes over.
Yeah.
It's not enough sometimes.
How do you separate business from the art?
Good partners, I guess. You know, for instance, when it comes to publishing is pretty much the exploitation of your work, which is very different from the exploitation of the artist. Music is meant to be exploited from a publisher's perspective. They have to find all the opportunities for your music. So if you have partners like that, they take care of that. So it means that you can then just focus on making music and staying in that lane, and making sure that you're just productive creating, because it's like a muscle. You need to kind of develop it and work at it every day, which is what we have, you know, as to our benefit, is that we spend a lot of time in the studio. And so now, a year into the journey, strategically, with a body of work, I can meet with people and say, listen, this is what we do. How can you kind of fit in? And so that's what it is. It's like you take on as much as you can initially, and then you hope to offload some of the critical skill sets and needs to people who know what they're doing. And there's publishers out there who have been doing it a long time. You always have to kind of make sure that they're going to give you a personalized service, because some people take you on as a publisher and just sit on your music, hoping to collect from whatever happens with the music without actively going out there and exploiting it. It happens a lot. So you have to find someone who's going to take your music and, as their mandate, go out there and try find opportunities for it to work more than just it existing on the streaming sites or on YouTube or whatever. And even then, you still need people who are forward thinking and know about the technologies that listen out for all that stuff, because your music could be, you know, as a South African artist getting played in Norway by someone watching your music video, or someone's playlist, or who's influential and got people who are looking at the playlist and, you know, all these views. It's all income. So you need people who know how to track that and get you your money. So, you know, when speaking to the publisher, one of the challenges he was saying that Africa faces, that people don't know that. They don't know that if your song is, like, if you're a Kenyan artist and your song is playing in Europe somewhere, that you gotta get your money coming your way. You know, a lot of people just kind of make music with the mindset to perform it and don't realize that publishing is a huge income stream if you have people who know what they're doing looking after your best interests.
What advice would you give to a young Gamza out there, be her a woman, a young man, in terms of really taking that risk and going, okay, listen, I know what I want to do. This is the industry I love, and I want to go out there and really accomplish this.
I think just have to be realistic that it doesn't happen overnight. Like I say, we've been running for a year. And I mean, I think most people agree that, like, in business, it's only maybe 2 or 3 years that you start becoming profitable. And so you have to kind of give yourself that padding to know that it's not going to be, you know, great for that first year or two, and that you have other ways to kind of monetize your skill. So with us, for instance, you know, we have the not so glamorous stuff of doing, you know, video production, final mix, recording voiceovers. It's kind of stuff that keeps the lights on, but is not necessarily what you find people are passionate about. I don't know anyone who's passionate about recording and mixing voiceovers, unless you're an engineer who loves to work with the art of, like, Foley and sound effects to make sure things sound legit. I mean, it's got its people, but yeah, I mean, we do that stuff just because, in addition to us keeping the lights on, you kind of learn how to work with the Swiss Army knife that is your machine, that is your studio, knowing how to get the best out of it. And so, yeah, do that and be excellent at what you do, because if you're not, someone else most times will be. And so also, we don't all have to be producers. We don't all have to be the star. We don't, you know, get into the legal aspect, get into the so many offshoots of the music business.
If you just get the music out there as well, like you mentioned.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, we've gotten to a point where, you know, people think you got to get on Apple Music and Spotify and all these things. And in essence, you actually just become like everybody else. So, you know, I mean, DJ Marshmello, I always kind of go back to his example. He's a guy who was just giving away music to the point where, you know, people were expecting just this free stream of music. And then he monetized that as a DJ to be able to go and perform that music. And now he's, you know, making songs with the biggest stars in the world. So, you know, you almost have to take it on, take that knock initially. To be honest, I mean, also streaming isn't the biggest amount of income. So, you know, you also want to just kind of find a way of, like, monetizing your fan base in other ways. So you can kind of give them the music for free initially. And then as you grow, there's merchandise, there's performances, there's other ways of kind of making money from them, as opposed to them listening or being forced to listen to your music in an enclosed environment, which is, you know, the streaming world is, in a sense. A lot of the time you have to pay some sort of subscription fee to get the most out of it. So if you are, as a musician, saying to your fans that, listen, I don't want you to have to deal with that. Sure, if you're on Spotify and Apple Music, it's fine. Enjoy. But if you're not and you like what I do, get on my SoundCloud. Here it is. It's free. Enjoy. Let's build a bond. That way, you know, when I do other things in future, because you're paying attention to my career and I've kind of had this goodwill relationship between you as my fans and me as the artist, there's somewhere along the value chain where I'll get my money out of this relationship that I fostered. So it's just all those things that you gotta have. You have to approach it in a different way. You know, is we all kind of clamor to do the same thing without realizing there's nothing unique about us by doing that thing. So you have to get creative and think out the box a little bit.
Go on to a classic. Think out the box. I like that. Kamza, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
I think that's it from this side. Where can people find you? Where can they follow you?
So I'm on Twitter at Gamzambata. Yeah, I'm more of a voyeur on Twitter, I must be honest. I go on there to kind of keep up with what's happening, and you know, every now and again I'll tweet, but a lot of the time it's just kind of my main source of news and keeping an ear to the ground, so to speak. And so yeah, but there you'll kind of, you know, keep up with what I'm up to as far as the music stuff and with the sports as well. Like I moved away from Super Sport, but I didn't move away from sport completely. Mm-hmm. So I do a podcast with some young energized guys who are looking to, you know, kind of change the space a little bit as far as sporting podcasts are concerned, and it's nice to work with young people because, you know, in a sense nothing is impossible to them, so it's just like, why not do it? Like, you know, there's no barriers, whereas if you work in a corporate structure to get anything off the ground,
it's stiff.
Yeah, it's a lot more stiff.
And where can people find this podcast?
The podcast, it's at FRUN_news. Mm-hmm. So it's called Front Runner. So yeah, people can follow the portal. We're obviously on a break right now because the season, as far as the local Absolute Premiership is concerned, has taken a break, so we're going to resume proper in August again when the season does. But yeah, I mean, yeah, on Twitter,
production company,
at Kingmaker _ KNGMKR _ on Instagram, and on Twitter, keeping you abreast. So what we're going to do is, I mean, we've taken this decision to roll out all our music. Our entire catalog will be on our SoundCloud, available for free download probably as of next week. So just keep your ears to the ground. I mean, I think we'll be more impactful. I think we've kind of spent the last year just incubating ourselves and learning our craft and learning the landscape, and hopefully now that we know what we know, we'll be able to leverage that into other positions.
Love it. Right, thank you so much again for joining us.
Not a problem.
Make sure to tweet us at Sebenza Live on Instagram, and also just DM us on Twitter if you have any more new news to share with us.